The last case set for argument this morning is appeal number 30443, State of South Dakota versus Dion Bordeaux. Kyle Beauchamp is arguing on behalf of appellant Mr. Bordeaux, along with Angela Colbath. And then we have Paul Sweetland arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. I understand, Ms. Colbath, you'll be taking the initial 15-minute argument, and then Mr. Beauchamp will have the 5-minute rebuttal. With that, then, Ms. Colbath, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. We are here today because of the trial of Dion Bordeaux, wherein he was charged with first-degree premeditated murder. The court erroneously allowed character evidence to be introduced. That character evidence was compelling in the jury reaching the decision. Now, in establishing the test under 404B, whether character evidence or what could be character evidence is being introduced for a non-character purpose, there are two parts to that test. One's a factual analysis, one's a logical application. For that reason, the facts in this case are extremely important in understanding where the court erred. Dion was at a motel in Rapid City on New Year's Eve 2019. He was there along with his girlfriend at the time, Jeanette Jumping Eagle, his brother, and throughout the night, various other individuals in and out of the hotel. Now, Dion, his brother, and Jeanette were the three consistent persons who had been at that room. Argument, light argument, disagreement, perhaps is a better characterization, had been occurring between Jeanette and Dion. They had been disputing about some alleged infidelity and had some disagreements throughout the night. Ultimately, late in the early morning hours, around 3 o'clock a.m., it was just Giovanni, Dion's brother, Dion and Jeanette left in the room. Giovanni had made arrangements to leave the motel and was awaiting a ride from a couple co-workers. Dion, given the tenor of the night with him and Jeanette, had decided that he was going to leave as well. Dion went in the motel room, which this was a standard type motel room with a little kitchenette, a queen bed, a couch, TV, and one bathroom. Giovanni, Dion's brother, went in to use the bathroom and heard a loud bang. Gio's testimony indicates he was in there for just a minute or two and was near finishing his business, if you will, when he heard the bang. He walked out to find Dion standing against the wall across the room from a couch where Jeanette Jumping Eagle was sitting and had been shot in the head. Now, Dion is described by his brother as being panic, frantic, shaking, and when Gio asks what happened, he repeatedly says, "I don't know. I don't know. I don't know." He walks to the couch, caresses Jeanette's head to see if she can be saved, if she can be helped, and simply says, "Baby, baby, baby." In that stage, both men are terrified and decide they're leaving the room. Now, important as to a reason why that might be instinctive, is evidence showed at trial that Jeanette had engaged in drug distribution. Distribution that perhaps had been occurring that night, and drugs were found in the room. Neither of these individuals wanted to be connected to that. But what's more important is as they leave the hotel room, they're walking down the street. Dion repeatedly says, "We need to call the cops," and does just that. He calls law enforcement within a couple blocks of the motel, tells law enforcement, "My girlfriend just shot herself. Here's where she's at," gave him the accurate location, proceeded to give law enforcement or dispatch his accurate location. "I'm standing by Runnings, a store in Rapid City. This is what I'm wearing. This is where you can find me." When law enforcement responds to Dion's location, he's cooperative with them. He tells them, albeit not an accurate description of what happened immediately before the room, but he's cooperative in the sense of he agrees to talk to law enforcement. He agrees to go to CID, the Criminal Investigations Division, for a further interview. While he's there, he consents to have his body processed, collecting his clothes, collecting swabs of his hands, and other evidence. He provides law enforcement, the officer at the scene where he is found, at Runnings, his phone. Shows law enforcement communications that were on his phone. And interestingly, Jeanette's name is in there, text messages are reviewed, and she's identified simply as Babe. Now, Dion and Giovanni both go to CID and cooperate. Meanwhile, at the scene of the motel room, law enforcement, a large law enforcement presence is there, and they began treating it like a crime scene, taking photos, collecting evidence. In this case, there was a significant evidentiary issue that's important because when weighing the balance of the strength of the state's case in considering whether this improper 404B influenced the outcome, these significance disputes are very important. In this case, one of the primary disputes was whether the gun that was found in Jeanette's lap was in safe mode. The dispute came not from the defense, but from two of the state's witnesses. One, an officer who responded, his testimony was that upon going into the room, he carefully removed the gun from under Jeanette's hand, which was sitting on her lap, and went to clear the weapon. And in doing so, when he went to rack the slide, determined he couldn't because the gun was on safe. Now, the significance for the state's argument is that that was indicative not of a suicide, because the entire defense in this case was not that a murder or any crime had been committed, but that Jeanette Jumping Eagle took her own life. Obviously, if a gun is in safe mode, a person after being shot in the head would be unable to do that. Where the conflict came is from the state's expert evidence technician who collected the evidence at the scene. Bincy Thankachin testified that she was the one that collected the gun, and she was adamant about it and the importance of why she would do that, because she's the person tasked with first photographing the scene and to ensure that no evidence has been manipulated, altered, or in any way contaminated with. She's certain...
But you got to win on your 404B issue first, right?
We do.
So, and I get it, and I understand that you think that this was devastating in the scheme of it all, prejudicial, didn't balance under prong two. But if you could, let's talk a little bit about this other 404B evidence.
Certainly. So the evidence that was offered at trial for 404B came from one witness, Melissa Herbold. Melissa was lived in T, South Dakota. Her boyfriend was potentially related to Dion. I say potentially because the evidence wasn't really clear. She describes him as maybe a cousin, a distant cousin, but a best friend to her boyfriend, Kane. Melissa testified about an event that occurred about 4 months prior to the event at issue, wherein an altercation happened in Melissa's home between her boyfriend, Kane, and Dion. In that instance, Melissa describes being in Sioux Falls visiting her parents when she receives word that Dion is coming over, someone she hasn't seen in a long time. She gets home. Dion is there with her boyfriend, Kane, and the two are drinking. She describes being upset about Dion being there because he's drinking and she knows they're going to drink. She introduces him to her newborn daughter, who's about a month old. That's significant, as it indicates Dion's not a regular guest at this house. She, along with her baby, go in the back room, and ultimately, they're being loud out in the living room. She goes out to tell him to quiet down. And when she goes out, she describes at trial seeing Dion pinned against a wall by Kane, and Dion is stabbing him. Ultimately, they tumble to the floor where Kane subdues Dion, and she takes a knife out of Dion's hand. They both sit up, and she describes appearing to be so drunk that they kind of don't even know what's going on. Dion then assists Kane in getting up, going out to a car, and takes him to the hospital. Now, Melissa, through her own testimony, acknowledges that ultimately, well, she didn't call law enforcement. She didn't report a crime had been committed. She didn't go to the hospital. Instead, she covered up a crime scene or a scene. She removed the beer cans. She cleaned up the blood in the apartment, the bloody items in the apartment, and disposed of the knife.
Is there any evidence that was presented at trial that Dion was part of that cleaning up the scene?
Absolutely zero. In fact, there was evidence to the contrary. Melissa's testimony was that Dion left the apartment in T and drove with a neighbor to a hospital in Sioux Falls. No discussion was had about what to do next. No discussion by Dion was had about calling law enforcement.
So you had a significant motion in limine issue in front of the trial court trying to decide if this 404B evidence was going to come in. And of course, one of the assessments is we don't want to have a trial within a trial. So we have the testimony from Ms. Herbold at trial. It's different than her than what she says in the police reports, what she tells the police reports. You're put in a position, do I want to challenge this? This is evidence I didn't want in. Now I got to start asking questions and cross-examining this witness. And you did, and challenged her testimony. That's part of the issue in this case as well, is now we're trying two cases rather than one. And I know you limited that, but that's the position you were put in. Can you comment on that?
Sure, absolutely, and that's exactly right. And that's evidenced by, I think, some of the analysis in determining whether this evidence is admissible. Because the factual similarity is a consideration that must be taken by the trial court. The facts of the case at hand and the prior acts. And in doing that, we were put in a position to challenge not only that pretrial, but during trial. Because Melissa Herbold was the only witness for the state on the prior acts. The victim, alleged victim in that case, Kane, was not there. He did not provide testimony. That's significant because the state asserted that these were similar victims and similar acts. And the evidence simply didn't support that, not in the pretrial testimony or in the trial testimony. On the one hand, we have Jeanette Jumping Eagle, who is a romantic partner of Dion's. On the other hand, we have a childhood best friend who he doesn't see very often. One's female, small in stature. Another is a male relative, perhaps, or best friend. The state also suggested that similar to in the cases were that an argument had ensued. However, that's just simply not what the record bears. The record bears nothing about what occurred between Kane and Dion prior to the physical altercation. Melissa didn't hear what was being said. She didn't hear an argument. She heard only loud voices. In the case with Jeanette, the allegation by the state is Dion staged it to look like a suicide and tried to make the analysis or the analogy that in the prior case that he had cleaned up the crime scene, but there's simply no evidence, none, no evidence that he even suggested it, had a thought about it, or had any knowledge that Ms. Herbold had done that.
Crimes themselves are different. Two, the crimes themselves are different.
They are.
And the circuit court relied in part upon the permissible 404 justification of intent. The intent requirement for these two crimes is also very different, isn't it?
It is. The crime of first-degree murder is a specific intent crime.
Whereas?
General intent for ag assault.
Very, very strong.
The other thing that's significant, and I would just ask the court, the analysis in Lassiter is very, very analogous here. In Lassiter, this court found that the only purpose for the purported evidence was to prove that the defendant had acted violently before, so they must have this time. That is true in this case. That's highlighted, I think, by the state's own arguments in both opening statement and closing. In opening statement, Mr. Schiffermiller says twice to the jury, you are going to hear that Dion gets drunk and violent. In closing, Mr. Krull says twice, talking about Dion drunk and violent, and then highlights it with the phrase, sound familiar? We heard that from Ms. Herbel. That's what he does. He drinks and gets violent.
Can you briefly address prejudice? The question, I mean, was your client prejudiced by this alleged improper evidentiary ruling?
Yes, thank you. He absolutely was. Again, that goes back to some of the inconsistencies and the weaknesses in the state's otherwise evidence presented in this case. There was just as much, if not more, evidence that supported the theory of suicide than there was of murder. But for the state improperly being allowed to introduce the character of Mr. Bordeaux, or the purported character of a drunk and violent man, that tipped the balance. Again, I think Lassiter is insightful. In Lassiter, the first go-round, the jury was unable to reach a decision in the case. In the retrial in Lassiter, that's when the state added new evidence by way of 404B, and that resulted in a conviction. Of course, there's no way of knowing. We can't get into the minds of the jurors directly to know if that is the only thing that made the difference. But the nature of the state's arguments in and of itself, the emphasis that they put on the nature of Mr. Bordeaux's character, tells this court all it needs to know. It tells the court that the state believed that that information was critical in making the determination of Mr. Bordeaux's guilt in this case. For this reason, there's no permitted purpose that this evidence would be introduced. Drunk and violent, that was the purpose, to describe Mr. Bordeaux as drunk and violent. And in, we don't try cases that way. We don't put people to prison in prison for their character, but only for the crimes they committed. In this case, this court should reverse the trial court and grant Mr. Bordeaux a new trial. There's no other way for him to get justice without that being the ruling. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sweetland, you can proceed with our argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Dion Bordeaux shot his girlfriend, Jeanette Jumping Eagle, in the head in a hotel room on New Year's Eve and staged it to look like a suicide. Badly staged to look like a suicide. Bordeaux and Jeanette had been drinking and arguing that night over her suspicion that he had cheated on her to Bordeaux's brother Giovanni, the only other person present in the room. They appeared to be breaking up. In the early morning hours, when Giovanni was in the bathroom, Bordeaux shot Jeanette in the forehead with a Ruger semi-automatic pistol while she sat on the couch plugging her charger cord into her cell phone. At his trial for first-degree murder, the court admitted evidence of an assault that Bordeaux had committed only 3 months earlier, in which he stabbed his cousin 9 times in the torso, nicking the left lung and narrowly missing his heart. The trial court admitted this prior assault pursuant to 404B, finding that the two incidents had sufficient points in common.
The court relied upon intent and common plan or scheme. As it relates to those permissible bases, how did these two offenses or the evidence of these two offenses align?
And that's the reason the court admitted the evidence was because it was indicative of intent. And in both instances...
Intent to do what? I guess I'll ask it that way. Well, intent to do what?
Well, in both cases, Bordeaux had been drinking with a victim with whom he had a close familial-type relationship, which led to a sudden violent attack.
How could the intent to commit a general intent crime when you're in that state be a point that's in common with committing the offense of premeditated murder when the evidence seems to indicate he wasn't that drunk?
Well, 404B doesn't require a conviction. It requires the comparison of acts. And in this case, the act of stabbing Kane was intentional. Kane didn't accidentally stab himself. So he was stabbed 9 times intentionally. So the intent was there in both cases to inflict or to resort to lethal force in the course of a disagreement.
Are there other cases in our jurisprudence that apply an intent theory where the other act was a general intent crime?
Well, it's a question of the act itself, not a matter of what they are convicted of.
Well, are we talking more about motive, which is a different thing? But I'm still trying to figure out what the theory was as to what the intent was, other than just the intentional physical act that would equate to the type of intent that is required to show first degree murder.
Well, the intent was Bordeaux reacting violently to a person with whom he's having a drunken disagreement.
If that were the test, then it would seem like every violent act that someone has committed in their past would be admissible under 404B in a trial for even a vastly different violent act. I know you don't agree with that, but extrapolating that out, maybe your thoughts on that, Mr. Sweeney.
I think that there have to be sufficient points in common. And here you have these sufficient points in common. A late night drunken argument with somebody with whom he has a personal...
Well, now you're getting into common plan, and that goes to common plan or scheme. That's different than intent. That's a different test. But go ahead and address your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, the court said intent, but as this court has found, the court need not delineate every reason in its decision for why the evidence is relevant. In Lassiter, this court made the observation that even though the court had not delineated every possible authorization for the admission of this evidence, it could still come in. So intent, motive, pattern, plan, identity even in this case, because Bordeaux denied that he was that he shot her and made a suicide defense, which obviously put identity into question.
So, well, even if there were sufficient points in common or some intent issue, that doesn't seem to be the way the state presented or argued this to the jury.
Well, the state said that he's violent when he's drunk.
How is that getting at sufficient points in common, or there really was no comparison to the actual facts as far as the way the state used it, was there?
I think the facts of the two, the 404B and the charge defense, were effectively identical. The only difference is that Kane was his cousin, not his girlfriend, and he used a knife instead of a gun. Other than that, you have two people up late arguing late at night. They're drunk. They've been drinking. And Bordeaux gets mad, and he uses lethal force against the object of his anger.
You know, that I hate to pick a nit, but, you know, when you pass over the drunk versus drinking, that seems like it could be very much a point that's not in common. So the 404B witness said Bordeaux was really drunk. As Ms. Colbeth said, and that's exactly, you know, from the record, really didn't seem to know what he was doing. That's not at all the theory in this case, though. In fact, it's rather inconsistent with premeditated murder.
Well,
in addition to the relative state of his intoxication, doesn't seem at all to be to the state where he wouldn't know what he was doing. That seems very different.
Well, he did raise that point to the police officer when he was interviewed. He tried to make a blackout defense, one of his many inconsistent defenses that he's raised. He tried to make a blackout defense, and the police officer noted to him that his blood alcohol at that time was not high enough to be extrapolated backwards for him to have been in a blackout state. However, the timeline that you're talking about, Your Honor, that comes strictly from the defendant. We don't know at what time he shot her. We don't know how long after he shot her they left the hotel.
I suppose you're right, but ultimately you're the proponent, the state's the proponent of the evidence, and so it bears the burden to demonstrate under our cases how this evidence, which might otherwise be viewed as propensity evidence, is nevertheless, or character evidence, is nevertheless admissible under one of these 404B bases.
Well, so, there's no dispute that he was drinking. There's plenty of alcohol in the room, so it's a matter of how drunk was he. We don't really know that because we don't know at what time he shot her. We don't know at what time after he shot her he left the hotel.
So that really couldn't provide a basis for a point in common. If you don't know and you're the proponent of the evidence, because the evidence doesn't show it, then you really can't say that, yeah, this is like the circumstances where the 404B witness described him as being so drunk, or he was so drunk he didn't know what he was doing. And if the response to that is, yeah, we really don't know if that was exactly the way it went down in this case, that would seem like it's a point not in common at all.
Well, it's a point in common that he was drinking on both nights, and at what point in his stages of drinking he becomes homicidally violent, we don't know that for sure, but we do know that the point in common is that they were drinking and they were arguing.
And counsel, I'd like to hear your argument on prejudice.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Ms. Kolbath has argued that her client was prejudiced by what she deems an improvident admission of this 404B evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. Prejudice mainly looks at, in this circumstance, the importance of the 404B evidence to the state's case and to the overall strength of the state's case. Here, the indicia of the staged suicide were very compelling. First of all, there was no contact wound. Normally in a suicide, the suicide places the gun in contact with their head, and that causes a burn wound from the expulsion of the gases from the muzzle of the gun. So this gun was fired not in contact with the head, but at a distance from the head. The angle of the gun was from high above the right eyebrow to the base of the skull. There were bullet fragments found in the victim at the base of her skull. So that suggests a downward trajectory, in other words, consistent with Bordeaux standing above her while she's sitting on the couch and shooting her in the head. Jeanette's cell phone cord was wrapped around her little finger twice. So to accept the scenario that she shot herself, the jury would have had to accept the scenario that she lifted this gun up at a high right downward angle above her forehead with her cell phone cord and her cell phone dangling in front of her face at the time she shot herself. There was gun residue on Bordeaux's right hand. After Jeanette was shot, the gun, according to Bordeaux, fell on her right thigh with her hand atop the gun. Well, that's more of a television notion of what happens in a suicide, that the hand and the gun drop. But what actually happens is, as soon as there's loss of neurological control, which is instantaneous, the hand loses the grip and the objects fall independently of each other. So the idea of a telltale gun in hand is more of a television notion of what a suicide looks like, and in real life is more of an addition of a staged suicide rather than an actual suicide.
But you've got a pathologist coming in and saying this could have been suicide, or it may have been homicide, death from another person. I mean, the pathologist is saying there's some evidence indicating both potential scenarios.
Well, pathologists can only opine on the mode of death, gunshot wound to the head. The circumstances of the death are generally outside their area of expertise. However, Dr. Hobby did testify that in his experience in suicide cases, you have this contact wound because the gun is generally placed in contact with the head in order to control the aim.
But he couldn't reach a definitive conclusion.
That's a jury,
based on that.
It becomes
he said
jury.
That may be common.
It becomes a jury question, yes. Yes, Your Honor. When the police arrived, they found the gun in her lap with her hand above it. And Officer Detective Giese removed the gun, prepared it for evidence, and found that the safety was engaged. Now, she obviously couldn't shoot herself with the safety engaged, and she obviously couldn't engage the safety after she allegedly shot herself. So that shows that the gun had been handled after Jeanette was shot.
The safety being on doesn't really work with the staging theory, though, either, does it? It seems like the safety being on is kind of an interesting fact that doesn't really work well with either side's theory, does it? It doesn't really work with the staging theory either, would it?
Oh, absolutely it does, because we know Giovanni saw Bordeaux standing over Jeanette doing something with his hands.
Well, I guess my point isn't that he couldn't have been the one to turn it on, but if he was trying to stage it to look like a suicide, I think the argument was made by co-counsel at closing, then why would you turn the safety on if you were trying to make it look like a suicide?
He didn't do it on purpose. He obviously did it in a panic while he's trying to clumsily stage this thing as a suicide.
So he committed murder, but he's a scrupulous enough gun safety operator to put it on safety.
Well, I don't think he did it on purpose, Your Honor. I think it just happened in the course of him trying to stage the suicide.
But aside from that, was there other forensic evidence or other non-forensic evidence that you think supports the state's argument that there was no prejudice?
Two things, Your Honor. First of all, there were blood transfer stains on her arm and on her hand, which means that the arm and the hand were moved. Second of all, there were text messages between Bordeaux and Jeanette a week earlier. They were breaking up in these text messages. The first, she tells him, or Bordeaux texts her, and he says, quote, "You're mine." Jeanette's response, quote, "Nah." Bordeaux then responded, quote, "Bitch, I love you. Now I gotta kill you." So Jeanette was not distraught over breaking up with Bordeaux. She was dumping him. She's not gonna shoot herself over this guy. However, Bordeaux, his text message chain shows that his mind had turned to violence at the thought of losing Jeanette.
Do you have the rest of that text message before you? There was another line in which she responded.
No, I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor, but
I'm sure we may hear about it. But anyway, in which she references the fact she has her own gun, in essence.
Yes, there's a W, which nobody knows what that means. And then she references the fact that she has her own gun. She says that in the context of, "I'm not afraid of you. I have my own gun." And it ultimately is the gun that Dion Bordeaux shot her with. We would ask, therefore, that this court affirm Mr. Bordeaux's conviction for first-degree murder. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Beauchamp, you can proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you. I think the most important thing that the state stood up here and said is that this becomes a question for the jury. Well, at the outset, that jury got to hear that Dion Bordeaux gets drunk and he gets violent. That had to stick with the jury for the entirety of this trial. Regardless of what defense was able to point to, they had that in the back of their mind, and where it's a close call, they're going to believe that if he did it before, that he must have done it again. That is the danger that this court discussed in Lassiter, that if you allow evidence of a previous assault only because it tends to prove that defendant did it before, that he must have done it again, that's inadmissible. And that's exactly what we have here. Now, Justice Devaney, you asked a question about any other case in South Dakota that discusses intent in this way. I can submit to the court, I couldn't find one. I know that the state couldn't as well, because they went out of state in the Colby case that they cite, and that one is distinguishable. Now, granted, it's not even going to be controlling authority here in South Dakota, but that was an issue where self-defense was an affirmative defense put forward. And so the Supreme Court of, I believe it was Louisiana, had the ability to show what that defendant's intent was. We don't have that here. The state also made reference to the fact that outside of the victims being different, a cousin and a girlfriend, and the weapons being different, a knife and a gun, these cases are incredibly identical. I don't know how the state can basically make that contention, because without those two things, there's nothing in common. And that's even if this court were to determine that a best friend, cousin, and a romantic partner are in any way a similar victim.
And the similarity is important, not just on general principles, but the similarity is sort of a euphemism or a shorthand way of quantifying probative force or relevancy. So more similarity, more probative force, more relevance, more strength going into the court's balancing test as the second part of our test for admission. So it's not just similarity, it's that in a proportionate way, more similarity balances more favorably for admission, less, not so much.
And I think that's where this case is distinguishable from what the court decided in Evans, where we do have quite a bit of time between the two victims, but it was similar enough based upon the relationship the defendant had with those two that it was admissible 404B. Once again, based off of the two different victims that we have here, there's not even remote similarity in that regard.
And so if there was error, how was your client prejudiced?
And Justice Kern, this wasn't a close call. This was a case in which, as the court pointed out, it could not be ruled out as a suicide. Dr. Hobby could not provide that testimony. On top of that, we did have issue with how this evidence was handled when law enforcement arrived on scene. No one could say who was the first one to actually hold this gun. No one could testify that that safety was absolutely 100%.
Actually, Detective Gizzy did and testify to that. When you say no one could testify, and then the state followed up on that also with redirect with the evidence technician from the PD, and she seemed to, in her redirect, concede that, yeah, I may have been testifying what my usual procedure is, but if Detective Gizzy's report says that he was the one that checked it, I have no reason to disagree with that. He then testified that he asked every officer on the scene and EMT personnel if anyone touched the gun and verified that they said no, which was consistent with his report. So in fairness, we mentioned that there was no evidence with regard to that, isn't that?
And if I misspoke, I do apologize, but I do believe that that creates an issue of fact for the jury to determine whether or not Detective Gizzy's testimony can be believed, and whether or not, based upon what the forensic analysis said prior, can match up with what was then testified by Detective Gizzy. I would also note that the state indicated some references to some text messages, and while there was evidence that message was provided by Jeanette, there was never at trial any indication that that text 100% came from Dion Bordeaux. The state knew at trial what they were able to do with this powerful propensity evidence. This case came down to the jury determining whether this was a murder or a suicide. And based upon the prejudicial propensity evidence, it had to sway that jury in their opinion that a defendant who had pled guilty to a violent crime before must be guilty in this instance. That is the prejudice when we have a close call, that what the state was allowed to testify or to argue from the outset of this trial was going to stick with them for the entirety of the case. I would ask that you reverse Dion Bordeaux's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. That will conclude our arguments for today. We'll be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thank you.